You're listening to The Point. Kenneth Graham's classic The Wind in the Willows introduced generations of children to the characters of Toad, Mole, Badger, Otter, and Rat. In the Wake of the Willows is a new sequel to the beloved classic, written by a resident of South Dartmouth. It's set on the banks of the Westport River and takes readers on adventures to many familiar places along the Cape, Islands, and South Coast. Joining us is author Frederick Thurber. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
And also with us, illustrator Amy Thurber. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Mindy. It's great to be with you.
So generations who've read The Wind in the Willows probably feel great affection for the characters of Toad, Mole, Badger, and Rat. Frederick, what prompted you to consider writing a sequel, and did you have any reservations about taking on such a responsibility?
Well, I had written a nature column for a good 20 years or so in the area, and my wife wanted me to write a book with my nature observations. So I was injured with a chainsaw, and I was confined to bed for 3 weeks, and I had nothing else to do, so I reread The Wind in the Willows, and I said to myself, well, why couldn't I do my own version of Wind in the Willows, but set it locally in the New World? Because there had been a number of other sequels to Wind in the Willows, and they were all in England, but how about a version for the New World? So I set to work, and my wife encouraged me to do this. She said that since I resemble Mr. Toad in so many ways, I might as well write about him. Isn't that sweet of her?
Yeah. Amy, you've pointed out that there are some aspects of Frederick in the character of Toad. So how would you describe the character of Toad in The Wake of the Willows and in contrast to Kenneth Graham's original character?
Well, they are very different. This is an evolved and more mature Toad, Mr. Toad. So I think in the original Wind in the Willows, Mr. Toad was certainly a rolling cannonball. But he had obsessions, and his obsessions were usually what got him into trouble. That still carries through to a degree in his son, Toadie. But I think Fred, my husband, is very, very familiar with the whole obsession motivated lifestyle. For many years, he was obsessed with bird watching, which was wonderful. And then it moved on to things like heirloom roses, scented roses, fragrant flowers, and then most recently rhododendrons, where he's become quite an expert and has been breeding rhododendrons from original species in the Himalayas. So I see Mr. Toad in my husband for sure. And I think he's done an excellent job in bringing Mr. Toad to life as a mature adult in The Wake of the Willows.
So in The Wake of the Willows, it's set on the Westport River, but there are many sea stories and nautical references. The story has the feel of a seafaring adventure, and anyone who considers themselves a mariner will be hard-pressed to take issue with any of the nautical references. Frederick, are some of these sea stories your own?
Yes, actually, quite a few of them, sort of based on my wild teenage years. I misspent my youth chasing striped bass and saconnet in Little Compton and Westport area and Buzzards Bay, and also out of Woods Hole. I spent a lot of time fishing out of Woods Hole, exploring the islands and hanging out with some naturalists there in the hole and biologists. And that all became part of the story and woven together.
There are illustrations at the start of each chapter, and most of the illustrations are either nautical or of the natural world. Amy, would you describe some of the illustrations for us?
Well, a lot of the illustrations are sort of still lifes or just little vignettes of nature. So I tried to read mysteries into each chapter that would sort of evolve through the chapter and be answered at the end. So each one of the illustrations, I tried to create a little mystery and give them a hint of what might be to come in the chapter. So, for instance, on chapter one, we have a picture of a piece of birch bark with a catamount etched into it. And that actually is something that's answered at the very end of the book. But it helps to allude to the fact that there's a mystery in chapter one that needs to be solved. And the book basically follows you through and continues to give you little bits of that information until the end of the story.
So how much collaboration was there between you and Frederick on what illustrations would be?
Oh, gosh, that was challenging. I actually have done illustration in the past, and most of the illustrations for his bird column I produced very quickly. In other words, he would come up with a theme, and he'd have his article written within a few hours, and the deadline was the next morning, and I'd be racing to try and do a drawing. So a lot of the collaboration that we did back in, you know, the 20 years that he was doing his nature columns came back in this book, and I was able to have the luxury of developing them slowly. Many times the illustrations would take shape, and in my head I would say, it just has to come. I have to wait until I get my inspiration. The part one, part two, and part three illustrations actually took about 3 years later
wow.
than the other illustrations. So they definitely were later on, and they are more full-page illustrations that are more scenic and so on.
And do you have a favorite illustration in the book?
Well, I love the Luna Moth. I think that's my favorite, which is on chapter 14. It's always been a creature that I'm fascinated with, and I remember when we were first dating, Fred and I went to watch loons, and there was a Luna Moth that had been hit by a car or something in front of us on the side of the road, and we stopped and we looked at it, and I was just amazed at how large it was, mm-hmm. and how fuzzy, and how what an interesting shape, and luckily it did fly off. But that, I think that's my favorite illustration. Mm-hmm.
What about you, Frederick? Do you have a favorite illustration?
I guess the Luna Moth would be right up there for me also, because I'm mm-hmm. just intrigued by these mysterious insects. I think, and also the illustration at the start of the book is very interesting, I think, where it's a moonlit picture of the river at night. Sort of intriguing, and there's a little bit of mystery there in the beginning of the book, and I think that illustration sort of transmits or shows that mystery.
Yeah. Now, Ricky is Rat's daughter. She's in tune with the natural world and eager to learn more about it. She doesn't seem to care what others think, and you can tell she'll go on to do great things in life. So, Frederick, tell us more about the character of Ricky and what inspired her.
Well, I think Ricky was partially inspired by my wife. My wife was always a naturalist. She grew up in the woods, and she had a curiosity about the natural world. And that's how we met. We met on a bird walk. I was leading a bird walk, and she started to come to that book. She went to that bird walk and started to come to subsequent bird walks, and I finally got the message. Ricky's a very inquisitive girl. She's very smart about digging up, finding mysteries, solving mysteries, and the big mystery at the beginning of the book is finally solved by her, along with some other mysteries.
Hmm. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Another aspect of Ricky that I think is very important is in the original Wind in the Willows, there really are no strong female characters. And when Fred was initially trying to come up with his storyline, he spoke at length with a friend who's an editor, and she said, if you do anything, make sure you have a strong female character. So I think he succeeded in that.
Yeah. There's a passage from the book that I hope you read for us. It starts that paragraph, the summer constellations. And before you read, give us a little background on where Rat and Ricky are and what they've been doing right before this paragraph begins.
Sure. They had heard a sort of spooky Native American prophecy about the stars falling from the sky. So that night they decided to sit out in the meadow next to their house and watch the stars come out and make sure they were all there. And, summer nights are wonderful in the meadow. And so we talk about that, and then I will read a short passage from this section. It starts out this way. The summer constellations were all in their place, but Orion, the hunter, and his winter brethren had not made their entrance. They were gathering their strength to keep watch over the long, cold winter nights to come. Ricky and her father would be sure to greet them when they glided in come November, with the juncos and winter sparrows trailing behind. The stars were all out, and Mr. Rat had settled in to tell his daughter the mythology of each constellation. But suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, Ricky saw a star flicker and vanish. "Dad, I think I just saw a star blink out," cried Ricky. Mr. Rat cracked a knowing smile and chuckled. "Look again, little one. Your stars have wings." And sure enough, a star lit up and rose to the heavens. Another dropped to the grass. It was the fireflies. They decided that they also wanted to celebrate this summer night with an aerial dance. As it got darker and more streaks and blinks and flashes painted the sky, other fireflies joined the melee until it appeared there was a Milky Way of fireflies above the meadow. It was as if the meadow did not want to give up the stage to the stars and the constellations and retain little sparks of the sun's vitality after dark. Each lightning bug made its rounds carrying a little elfin lantern. Unlike Toadie and Portly racing around like dervishes with their sparklers, the fireflies were cool and quiet. Nature is economical and bent to her purpose. She is unwilling to waste her energies on such extravagances. As Mr. Rat explained to his daughter, "Listen as you might, you will not hear a firefly. It's like trying to listen to a star." Ricky marveled at the mass of lights over the meadow. "What a crazy mixed-up mess," commented Ricky. "Do they ever bump heads or get tangled up?" "Watch carefully," said her father with a smile. Sure enough, as Ricky watched, she could see that this dance was carefully choreographed. Each little glowing orb seemed to have its own flight lanes and patterns, never getting too close or too far from the others. As Ricky examined these airborne do-si-dos, she started to wonder if they were all communicating with each other like some alternative community, aloof and alien to the day-to-day concerns of the river folk. "It's a dance. The fireflies are doing a dance," exclaimed Ricky. "What kind of dance?" asked her father with a chuckle. "How about a waltz?" asked Ricky tentatively. "I'm not so sure of that. How can you have a waltz in a hayfield?" "Why not? High heels and long dresses do not mix well with cow pies." "Oops," giggled Ricky. "It must be some other dance," prompted her father. "How about a square dance?" said Ricky. She loved square dances. "Yes, I think you're correct," said Mr. Rat with a smile. "We cannot have a proper square dance in a hoedown without someone calling the dance steps. And we definitely need a fiddler," said an intrigued Ricky. "This is going to be fun," she thought. "Ah, but we have a fiddler, lots of them. Listen carefully." Mr. Rat pointed out that all the clicks, buzzes, and trills from the meadow came from grasshoppers, crickets, and katydids playing their own little fiddles. They made their song using their foreleg as a bow and their wing edge as the fiddle. "Listen," he told Ricky, "this is the grasshopper playing a soft tune. Hear that delightful musical chirping? That is the field cricket. And the buzz? That is the handsome meadow katydid. And that lovely, sweet purring is a snowy tree cricket." "Wow, I had no idea. There's a whole ensemble of musicians right in our yard. It's easy to tune them out, and most of us do, alas. But oh, what they are missing. You need to listen with new ears and appreciate what we have. Enjoy these melodies now, little one, because one late November night, Orion will bring a killing frost, and you'll wake to the solemn silence of winter. We can't have a square dance without a song and the dance steps. What should we use for the steps?" Feigning outrage, Mr. Rat asked his daughter, "What? You don't know the lightning jitterbug? What's today's youth coming to? My goodness, I have not raised my child the right way." "Dad, please, I have never heard of it, nor I suspect as anyone else, because I think you just made it up." Her father chuckled. "Actually, I learned it from your grandmother. It goes like this. First, we need to tap our feet to get the beat just right, even if we only have two of them. Ready? Places all, let's go. Chicken in the bread pan, scratching up dough. Grab your partner and start to glow. Hay's in the hayloft, cider's in the cellar. turn to the left and curtsy to your feller. Shine, little glowworm, sitting on a branch. Wiggle your tail and make him do the dance. Cricket on a fence post, scritching out a tune. Swing your partner, fly her to the moon. Froggy on a banjo, picking on the strings. Swing to the sky like a star with wings. Allemande left, make your lanterns blink. Turn to your partner and give him a wink. Hoot, 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 clever old owl. Who's awake and who's on the prowl? Step right up and twinkle your toes, round and round till the darkness glows. Look up to your friends in the Milky Way, wing up to the stars and join the play. Oh, that's so delightful and so silly. I love it, said Ricky. Can I add a stanza? Sure. Each generation seems to add one. I added the froggy on a banjo. How about this, said Ricky, for she loved word games, puzzles, and rhyming. Swing your partner and do those flashes. Paint the sky with your dots and dashes. Ah, very good, most excellent. Although your grandmother did not know about dots and dashes, I think we should include that in the official version, don't you? There's no reason we cannot add some modern technology, such as the telegraph and Morse code, to the song. One more, asked Ricky. We never mention their feet. How about this? Weave your partners up and down. 6 little feet keep them off the ground. Ah, I like it. How about the whippoorwill or the nighthawk? We don't want to leave them out. Why are there no stanzas about them? This could go on all night, said her father with a sigh. I think we have enough verses. The whippoorwill stanza will have to wait for another night or the next generation.
That's so delightful. There are no illustrations of the characters. Amy, was that ever a discussion between you and Frederick about that?
Oh, yes. Initially, he wanted me to do illustrations of the characters and have them, you know, acting out different parts of the book. I've tried doing that in the past, and I found that it gave away too much. When I read a book, I kind of like to create images in my head of the characters, and when there's an illustration, sometimes it ruins it for me. I just find it gives too much away. There's another aspect to this book that is tricky, in that are these really animals or are they people? And I think that mystery should remain a mystery. I think it's really good to have us question that right along, you know, whether these really are people or animals. If we had illustrations of the characters, I think that would, again, ruin that point. So.
Yeah. Now, Frederick, you're a nature writer, and the references to the flora and fauna in the story are accurate. What were some of the most meaningful and important natural history aspects of the region that you wanted to incorporate into the story?
Well, I wanted to talk about some endangered and disappearing habitats and endangered animals. I wanted to make the readers aware of them and describe them in their native habitat and time frame. This book takes place in 1920, so things are a little different then. But I think one of the most important things was the bobolink. And a bobolink is a grassland bird that's disappearing rapidly in our area, although there has been a little bit of a resurgence in some carefully managed hay fields. I was talking to John Atwood from Mass Audubon yesterday, and he showed me some of the distribution maps for the bobolink, and it looks like they've been extirpated from the Cape Cod and Nantucket, but there does seem to be a colony at Chilmark. The good news is that Massachusetts Audubon is working very hard to bring these birds back, and there's been a big resurgence of them here in South Dartmouth. There's a tremendous colony of there's the grassland that's managed for warm season grasses, and the haying schedules have been adjusted to allow these birds to properly fledge their young. The big problem with bobolinks is they need large open grasslands that are not mowed too frequently. So that combination is tough to come by these days, but there is progress on that front. And so I devote a whole chapter to the bobolink. And the book has been very successful so far in that aspect, in that the kids who have read the book are very interested in actually seeing bobolinks, because the bobolink in the book is quite a interesting character. There are places where you can actually see bobolinks. down in the Westport, the Bayside restaurant, and you can just sit outside and you can watch bobolinks in the field across the way. In Rhode Island, there's a winery called Greenville Winery that has bobolinks in the field next to the winery. So they are around if you ask around, and local Audubon can help you with that.
Yeah.
There were some other issues, too. I wanted to bring up a topic that's sort of been forgotten in our area, is that we had a recent extinction of a bird in the Cape and Islands, and that's the heath hen. The heath hen used to be extremely widespread on the mainland. By the turn of the 20th century, however, its range had been severely restricted, and the last colony of heath hens was on Martha's Vineyard. And they lasted into the 20s or 30s before they were finally extinguished. One of the things that motivated me for the book is I collect old sporting books, and I'd read an old sporting book, and it mentioned that there was a colony of heath hens on a private island near Cape Cod. And I said, I can weave that into the story and speculate that maybe the heath hens were still there at the time that the story takes place.
The book is beautifully written and illustrated, and I know many writers and illustrators will be curious about your journey to publication. Do you have any advice for others who aspire to be published?
When I wrote the book, I didn't have a marketing plan, and I didn't identify an audience or anything like that. I just wrote the things that interested me, and I thought people would be interested in reading. So the book doesn't fit in a neat category as far as a children's book or an adult's book. It really is neither. It's sort of in between. I guess they're calling it a kid-adult book. So I tried to go through the children's book writers organizations to try to get it published that way, and it failed. There wasn't any interest in it because it didn't really fit any categories. Mm-hmm. We eventually self-published, and it's been tremendously successful in this area. It's a long journey. It's tough. It's not easy to self-publish. You have to have everything just right. You have to have a really good story. It has to be carefully edited. We went through a lot of interesting problems with editing. And you have to have a good illustration and graphic design. And when you self-publish, you have to do that all yourself. And you also have to do the marketing. But it worked out very well, and I think it was the right decision for us. I think even now, if we were approached by a traditional publisher, we'd probably say no.
Yeah, the book is In the Wake of the Willows, a sequel to Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows, written by Frederick Thurber and illustrated by Amy Thurber. We'll post links with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Frederick and Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.